Aye, aye. And I'll chase him round Good Hope, and round the Horn, and round the Norway Maelstrom, and round Perdition's Flames before I give him up. And this is what ye have shipped for, men, to chase that white whale on both sides of land and all over sides of earth, till he spouts black blood and rolls fin out. What say ye, men? Will ye splice hands on it now? I think ye do look brave.
That is Herman Melville. But what that also might pertain to is younger abstention and my good colleague, Sam Gedge, who joins us today on Short Circuit, your podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeals. I am your host, Anthony Sanders, who did not write Moby Dick, but did just read from it because I think it particularly pertained to what we're going to be talking about later. We're recording this on Wednesday, August 24th, 2022. And once again on the program is, again, my colleague Sam Gedge, who is going to talk about his white whale, Younger versus Harris, decided in 1971, as you'll know from the special we did last year with him and Professor Fred Smith of Emory. And he's here once again to talk about a case involving that precedent. So, Sam, welcome to Short Circuit.
Thank you, Anthony.
And Sam, I do say you make a little bit of a Captain Ahab impression these days. So I want to thank you for thinking towards the podcast with your current very manly beard.
Well, thank you, Anthony.
Someone else who does not have a manly beard, but in every other way is a great man, is someone who I have been trying to get on this show for a long time. And I'm even more excited to introduce him than to read a few words from Moby Dick. And that is Scott Flaherty. Scott is an attorney, including an appellate attorney at Taft Law in Minneapolis, formerly Briggs & Morgan. He's practiced appellate law in Minnesota and also at the trial level for many years. If you have a question on some obscure procedural rule in the Minnesota courts, he is the first person you should call. And finally, he has come on Short Circuit today to talk about a case of his choice. So, Scott, welcome to Short Circuit.
Thank you, Tony. That's very kind. And this is not only my first appearance here, but my first appearance on any podcast. So,
oh my! Well, we're breaking some ground here today.
Be gentle.
All right. Well, we'll skip some of the normal podcast antics then to ease you into this. But first, introduce yourself, what you practice, and you know why you like arcane rules of procedure so much.
Well, your intro was very nice. So I'm an appellate lawyer at Taft, Stettinius & Hollister here in Minneapolis. You know, because appellate law sort of is this umbrella term. I've touched a lot of different substantive areas of law under that umbrella. And Indian law is one such area that I've been working with a lot for the last several years, which is why I chose a recent Seventh Circuit case involving Indian law to discuss today.
So let's go to that case out of the Seventh Circuit that was decided just a week or two ago. I'm going to say this wrong.
Lacouture. I'll save you the...
Lacouture Orales band?
Yeah, no, Lacouture.
Oh, my God.
It's okay. Yeah, the French is
yes. Tough. We'll leave it there. Yeah, 2 years of high school French, very well spent for me. Versus Evers, the governor of Wisconsin. And my first question on this case for you to tell our listeners about it is, what is the difference between tribal law and Indian law? Because I guess this is a Indian law case, not a tribal law case.
So that's a great question. You said it correctly. This is an Indian law case, not a tribal law case. And the distinction is that Indian law is a body of federal law. You can think of it like, say, admiralty law, maybe, or patent law, right? So these are substantively federal law. Tribal law refers to the domestic law of tribes, right? So if a tribe, say, enacts a code, tribal law is the content of that tribe's law. So you can think of Indian law as federal and tribal law as analogous to state law, okay, is one way to think about it.
What would you call, say, the interaction between state law and tribal law, which that comes up in this.
I would still put that under Indian law, because as we'll touch on in this case, the ways in which state law can or cannot affect tribes is in large part and maybe even entirely governed by federal Indian law. And so I would still put that question under federal Indian law. There are some unusual exceptions, right? So tribes with treaties with states that predate the Constitution, for example, but by and large, I'd put it under the umbrella of Indian law.
Okay. Well, what's going on with this decision in Indian law?
So this case is about state taxation of land, and that's the 10,000-foot single-sentence summary. I want to take a step back from this case and lay out some general principles of Indian law that will sort of work us towards the dispute in this case and why I think it's interesting. So for those who don't know, federally recognized Indian tribes are what one Supreme Court case has referred to as domestic dependent sovereigns. So they are domestic. They are part of the United States. But at least as to federally recognized tribes, they also have certain forms of sovereignty. And generally subject to a bunch of exceptions, most of which we won't get into, that sovereignty is freedom from certain state and local interference in tribal affairs and for tribes who have reservations for on-reservation conduct and reservation land. So one crude rule of thumb you can go by is that states cannot impose property taxes on reservation land owned by tribes unless Congress has allowed it, and as we'll get into with this case, unless it is permitted under some other provision of federal Indian law, say. There are other, I want to stay focused on property for this case, but there's state criminal jurisdiction over tribal members and over non-Indians has been a hot topic in the U.S. Supreme Court's docket over the past several years. That, I think, is still evolving quickly following cases like the Cooley decision, which I think was last term or maybe two terms ago now. But what I liked about this case is it's on the non-criminal side of the house, which hasn't seen, to my recollection, quite as much recent attention from the U.S. Supreme Court. And this case picks sides on an already existing circuit split on the given question. And so it does seem reasonably likely to draw the U.S. Supreme Court's attention.
I see.
Okay, so that's kind of the table setting. Here's some important history relative to understanding this case. Initially, before the Articles of Confederation and before the Constitution, Indian tribes entered into treaties with Great Britain and with some U.S. states. Following the enactment of the Constitution, where Article 1 gave Congress power over commerce with Indian tribes, the federal government, this is a simplification, but it's basically true. The federal government took over all relations with Indians from the states. Again, oversimplification, basically true. Initially, during the early period, relations with most Indians were done via treaty. So the Article 2, President's Power to Make Treaties, ratified by the Senate. After many decades, I want to say by the mid to late 19th century, the treaty period ended. Congress passed a law saying no more treaties with tribes. We're going to use statutes. Now, some statutes since the beginning, and I say the beginning, I want to say 1790, I believe, was the first Intercourse Act. So statutes had always been used, but the treaty making period ends and Congress uses its statutory power to regulate the United States' dealings with tribes. I bring up treaties and statutes because this case and the two other cases that form its circuit split are about the differing effects, if any, between what happens when land is allotted under a treaty and what happens when land is allotted under a statute. In this case involves a couple different types of lands in Wisconsin where the Lacouturay Band has their reservation. It's in northwest Wisconsin, I believe not far from Hayward. The set of parcels that are interesting here are parcels that had been allotted to members of the tribe. I'll use band and tribe interchangeably. So parcels that had been allotted to members of the tribe under an 1854 treaty that had then at some point passed out of Indian ownership and had been owned by whites. I'll say whites to refer to, it could be anyone who is non-Indian. The exact demographics of the non-Indian owners of these parcels isn't, you know, the Seventh Circuit doesn't get into the detail and it doesn't matter. It matters that they are non-Indians, doesn't matter what their race is. So certain of these lands within the reservation, initially allotted to Indians, pass out of Indian ownership into non-Indian, or I'll say white for simplicity, ownership. Later, these parcels are then reacquired by either the tribe or tribal members, okay? And the dispute is, what happens to that land that has passed out of Indian ownership within a reservation and then comes back into Indian or tribal ownership? The question is, can the state impose property taxes? No party to this litigation disputes that once land passes out of Indian ownership to whites or non-Indians, it can then be taxed by the state. That's pretty, that doesn't appear to be disputed, and I think is pretty uncontroversial. The dispute between the parties is the four bands at issue in this case, they took the position that once the tribes or the bands reacquire the parcels, their treaty rights under the 1854 treaty preclude state taxation on this land. The state of Wisconsin takes the position that once that chain is broken, so once land ownership leaves the tribe of the Indians who are subject to the treaty, everybody agrees we can tax at that point. So Wisconsin says it doesn't matter if it later goes back to being owned by the tribe or members of the tribes, we still get to tax it. So taxation sort of follows alienation is the rule of thumb. And in fact, that was the rule articulated by the Ninth Circuit in a case called Lummi Indian Tribe several years ago. Ninth Circuit said alienation, taxation, once it leaves tribal ownership, you're off to the races. And it doesn't sort of, immunity from taxation doesn't spring forth if the land returns to tribal ownership. The Sixth Circuit later in a case called Kawina Bay, I believe was the name of it, disagreed with the Ninth Circuit, and they said, no, under the treaty rights are essentially rights that the tribe has if they own the land. They own the land, they can't be taxed under the treaty. They don't own the land, treaty doesn't apply. So there's a split between the Ninth and Sixth Circuit. Here's what I think makes this case interesting, and because of the way it was litigated, it wasn't wrongly litigated, but this doesn't jump to the fore from the Seventh Circuit's opinion the way I think it should. What's interesting here is really the interplay between the treaty power in Article 2 and the Indian Commerce Clause under Article 1 of the Constitution. Because the Sixth Circuit's reasoning, which holds that can't be taxed, right, once the tribe reacquires ownership, is based on a distinction that the Sixth Circuit draws and that the Seventh Circuit agrees with, which is as follows. When a reservation is created under treaty or allotments are allowed by a treaty, that is not, even if there's a little later disposal of the land, that isn't a sort of sufficient indicia that the United States, I should be fair, that is not an expression that Congress is going to allow the land to be taxed if the Indians acquire it. But those courts agree that if there had been a statute, so if this had been a statutory allotment rather than a treaty allotment, the answer would be different, if that makes sense. So once, if a statute allots the land under well-established U.S. Supreme Court cases, Cass County is a famous one from Minnesota, County of Yakima is an older one, and then there's an even older one from 1906. If Congress passes a statute allowing land to be alienated, later it can be taxed. Everybody agrees that's the case. The Sixth Circuit, now the Seventh Circuit say, you reach a different result if it's allotment under a treaty, because according to those courts, a treaty is not an expression of congressional intent, right? Because if the president signs a treaty, yes, the Senate ratifies it. So that's the rule of law that sort of comes out of this case. What's interesting to me about that is the Sixth Circuit case that's on one side of the split has a dissent. The Ninth Circuit case on the other side of the split also has a dissent. It's a very close case. I mean, this here, the Seventh Circuit reversed the district court in this case that came to the opposite conclusion. So you have, depending on how you count judges, right, you have maybe three, four, five, six groups of judges. Almost all of them are evenly split. And it's very close because in these older U.S. Supreme Court cases, they do talk about congressional intent, congressional intent, congressional intent. And so that language was seized upon by the Sixth Circuit, now Seventh Circuit. But you have to wonder, two questions to me spring to mind. You have to wonder two things. One, those older cases were talking about statutes. So, of course, we are looking at congressional intent. To my knowledge, no case answers the current open question, which is, well, what happens where a treaty rather than a statute allows this? Now that we have answers in three circuits so far, but I think to my mind, there's some theoretical problems with saying statutory allotment allows for later taxation, treaty-based allotment doesn't. Why are we drawing that line between the Article II treaty power and the Article I Indian Commerce Clause power? I don't understand the theoretical basis for that. Maybe it exists. Maybe I don't aware of it. Or maybe we should, maybe we're going to get it from the U.S. Supreme Court, but we'll see.
Well, in my very uneducated knowledge of Indian law that I got from the opinion, it seems to me it has something to do with that treaties were respecting tribes as sovereigns, whereas it doesn't, isn't it exactly the same with the statute power? And so is it with in when you're talking about a sovereign that you're going to be looking at the powers differently than in this post 1871, you know, statute setup that we have in the modern era? Is that too simple a way to look at it? Is that kind of what's driving it?
So that is an important distinction, no doubt, right? And that's a real distinction. And it is even one that sort of has a doctrinal basis, right? Could in theory justify something, but it seems like it actually ought to cut the exact opposite way here, because where treaties, you can think of treaties as contracts between sovereigns, right? And so the rule of law here says, well, the treaty power, which is more contractual as opposed to statute, which is unilateral. Statute is unilateral, right? Action by Congress. Well, in this unilateral action, we're allowing taxation to happen downstream following alienation. But in the treaty context, where the tribe sort of entered into this contract, knowing what it's doing, kind of had a chance to negotiate a treaty, we're protecting, quote, protecting tribes more when they enter into treaties, and we're protecting them less when there's unilateral congressional action. It seems like it ought to be the other way. There should be a higher protection for tribes when Congress acts unilaterally, as opposed to when tribes negotiate with treaties. Now, one response to that is, you know, some of these 19th century treaties, you can really look at them and say, fine, they're both sovereigns, but is this really a treaty of peers? Because, you know,
we all know that.
And so I think as a theoretical matter, we talk about them as contracts between sovereigns as facts on the ground. Maybe that's not always the case. But the distinction you just drew was kind of the district court. I don't know if it recognized, I don't recall if the district court recognized it explicitly here, or at least made reference to it. But it's a real distinction, but it's counterintuitive. And then the other thing I come back to is the U.S. Supreme Court has not articulated that distinction, to my recollection, between treaties and statutes in that way. So it's a long-winded way of saying, I don't know, that is a distinction. I don't know that it supports the outcome here.
If the court does, say, take this case or a similar case on this issue, again, this is my very unexpert question coming out. Do the recent cases in criminal law, especially the couple that come from Oklahoma, McGirt, and then just this last term, Castro Huerta, do they pretend anything on this question, or is it really a separate thing in Indian law?
I'm going to say briefly, the recent cases don't really answer this question because the things that were disputed there are either not disputed here or don't matter. So the criminal stuff, nothing criminal is in the mix here. And in terms of, you know, so the recent case about civil jurisdiction over non-Indians in Indian country, there's no dispute here in this case about where the Lacoutere Reservation is. And so the scope of Indian country is not at issue. No, this is sufficiently different. And the reason I picked it is because it was not a criminal or law enforcement case. It's pretty different.
I see.
Now, I want to give one caveat, though. There is a rule of law that could emerge from this case or any of these cases that it has not been adopted by any of the circuits to look at this, which you could say whether land allotted under a treaty can be taxed by a state subsequent to alienation turns on a particular treaty. I mean, that would be, and the text of any particular treaty almost always matters. That wasn't the result here. the Sixth Circuit considered the treaty language, but I don't think it was dispositive. So this case is interesting because I think it's got a split. It could go different places, and it could say some interesting things about the distinction between powers under Article 1 and Article 2, even if it's just the treaty-making power under Article 2 and the Indian Commerce Clause under Article 1. I mean, there's a bunch of interesting ingredients here in this case.
Can I ask a foolish question about this? I feel like we're kind of in a safe space here.
This is a safe space.
Yeah, no one's listening. So I noticed in the case, it sounds like the bands sued the government to stop the tax, and it just kind of raised red flags for me about the kind of the Anti-Tax Injunction Act. I assume there's an easy answer that I could Google, but if you know the answer, I'd be curious to hear it.
Well, I wondered what had happened. I looked at the district court record, and the last I saw, the bands had paid the tax under protest, which isn't really responsive to your question about... I think somewhere in the district court order, the state or local governments did make some argument along those lines, and I think the district court rejected it, but my recollection was it was not on Indian law grounds, and certainly it was not in the mix of the issues raised to the Seventh Circuit. That's my recollection. But these sorts of tax cases challenged by bands are not uncommon. It happens.
And for listeners' benefit, the act that Sam is talking about is that generally when you're suing about a tax, it is essentially it's very hard to get into federal court because you're expected to try to litigate that through the state court tax system, essentially. And this was listeners may remember, this was an issue in the Obamacare litigation where the court had to say, well, this isn't a tax, so we can adjudicate it, but it is a tax, and so therefore there's no constitutional problem with that part of Obamacare. Well, Scott, I think we're much more educated now, at least Sam and I, on the basics of what Indian law is. And this was very interesting to me because there's often litigation about whether something is tax exempted or not. And as the court notes, just like with tribes in this situation, there's nonprofits that aren't taxed for all kinds of reasons, including real estate tax, and they can go in and out of, you know, whether they are taxed on depending on who the owner of the property is. And so this is actually not too different than that situation. Well, a situation that is quite a bit different is foster care. And the horrific things that sometimes can happen in the foster care system, including, it seems, in West Virginia. So Sam has selected this case that, as he said earlier, has to do with foster care, but the actual opinion isn't really about it at all. It is about this thing that listeners can go back. We'll put a link to it and learn all about, which is called Younger Abstention, from the episode we did last year with Professor Fred Smith. And Sam is going to give us a little update on the latest in Younger Abstention and whether we're any closer to catching that white whale.
Well, thank you, Anthony. I think the answer is yes, at least in the Fourth Circuit. Okay. So, yeah, as you mentioned, this is a Fourth Circuit case. It's out of West Virginia. The underlying facts are pretty troubling. We can give a flavor of them in a second. But what the Fourth Circuit ends up talking about is kind of a grab bag of kind of Fed Court's esoterica, which we can talk about all of it if we want, but I'm going to home in on the younger part. We can leave the mootness and class actions for like a follow-on episode if the people demand it. But just by way of I think so. But by way of background, so West Virginia evidently has a pretty hair-raisingly terrible foster care system. There are lots of structural problems. Officials have unmanageable caseloads. There's short staffing. There's budgetary shortfalls. And the upshot is that, at least according to the plaintiffs in this case, that there's routinely just really terrible stuff going on in the foster care system. Just to give an example, one of the plaintiffs in this case, I assume they're proceeding under a pseudonym because it's a child, but they enter the foster care system when they're 4 years old. They're shuttled off to a psychiatric institution. They end up in a juvenile detention facility after some shoplifting when they're 10. They're like sleeping on a mattress on a cement floor surrounded by older kids. And then to top it off, they're shipped off to a different facility in a different state, which promptly becomes famous because like their admissions officer is charged with sexually abusing another child at the facility. So it's the entire thing sounds like a really horrific train wreck. According to the Fourth Circuit's opinion, this sounds like it's not a unique example. So a bunch of these foster children in West Virginia, they file a class action in federal court against the West Virginia agency that's in charge of handling the foster system. They raise a constitutional due process claim and a variety of federal statutory claims. And they're seeking to certify classes of foster kids. And basically, they're asking the federal courts to remedy, you know, what they view as constitutional and statutory violations that are happening at a system-wide level. They're asking for system-wide changes to fix those violations, and they're seeking that relief against the agency that handles the whole foster situation. Now, the district court dismisses the case. As you forecast, they didn't dismiss it on the merits, but on Younger abstention. So we've talked about Younger before, but basically it's the doctrine that says that even if you're bringing a valid federal claim, the federal court can kick your case out of federal court if your lawsuit would interfere with certain kinds of state legal proceedings that are pending in state court. One of them is, for example, criminal cases in state court. That's one example. Now, when federal courts engage in this exercise of kicking cases on Younger abstention grounds, they normally kind of recite the usual platitudes that have gone back to the 1971 case Younger versus Harris, the idea that this is all about federalism and respect for the state courts. And basically what it boils down to is they say, you know what, get out of here with your federal claims and go across the street to the state court and complain to them about it. So that's pretty much what the district court did in this case. But on appeal, the Fourth Circuit really kind of flipped the script in a pretty interesting way. And they said what I think very few federal courts, you know, ever say in this context, which is that federalism, kind of the motivating kind of principle behind Younger abstention, that federalism is actually kind of a two-way street. It's not just a label for, you know, kicking federal civil rights claimants out of federal court. It's not a label that, you know, government lawyers can latch onto to try to get themselves out of federal court. It's actually the whole point of federalism is so that people can have their rights vindicated, including their federally protected rights. And so what the majority in the Fourth Circuit really comes down to saying is that Younger abstention is a narrow doctrine. It's a narrow exception to the rule that people get to choose their forum. And it's narrow for a reason, namely that people with federal claims normally should have the right to present those claims in a federal forum if that's where they want to be. So that's kind of like, I guess, some high level kind of, I don't know, talking about federalism. But, you know, the Fourth Circuit's analysis really kind of starts off on a kind of a pretty straightforward doctrinal track. You know, the Supreme Court has said there's these three categories of state cases that can give rise to Younger. The majority kind of marches through them and says, yeah, there's state courts that are kind of involved in the foster care system. There are these periodic check-ins with the local courts. But it's not the kind of thing that the Supreme Court has said normally triggers Younger abstention. And that's all well and good. But the majority then really kind of goes a lot further. There's a very short dissent that complains about the majority spending another 17 pages on just pontificating about kind of these broader principles. And the majority kind of makes some points that I think kind of a lot of federal courts, you know, would benefit from hearing, which is the idea that, you know, when you're a foster kid, for example, or when you're in some other group of vulnerable people whose rights are being violated, often the only way that you're going to get a systemic remedy for those violations is through class action litigation. So here, for example, the West Virginia lawyers, the West Virginia agency said, well, you should apply Younger abstention because every single one of those kind of four-year-olds and preteens and adolescents in foster care, they can just argue for statewide systemic relief during their quarterly check-in with the local judge in
right.
state
I'm
court.
I'm sure their judge Virginia. Will be very interested in that.
Precisely. I mean, like, it's laughable. But it's also the kind of laughable absurdity that government lawyers raise all the time in this context and that federal courts often kind of buy into. But the Fourth Circuit really engaged with that in a way that you don't see very often and kind of said what I think our reaction was to that, which is that it's completely unrealistic to expect these kids individually to secure systemic structural relief and their individual check-in hearings. Basically, the idea that these systemic problems, these funding problems, these staffing problems, they demand systemic relief. And the most obvious way to secure systemic relief is through class action litigation. That's kind of the whole point that we have Rule 23 and we have class action litigation to begin with. So where the majority here comes down on is basically saying you just can't get that kind of systemic relief in these one-off state court proceedings. And for that reason, you can't just invoke Younger abstention reflexively and say, go take it up during your kind of quarterly 10-minute status conference in state court. I can keep going, but I guess I'll kind of try to bring us to a close on this line of the case, because I really think it's kind of exciting as far as Younger abstention goes, because it's a rare moment of judicial engagement when it comes to these kind of abstention principles. And frankly, you know, Anthony, you mentioned, you know, your former guest, Fred Smith from Emory. You know, a lot of what the Fourth Circuit majority is saying here has echoes of what Professor Smith has written about. You know, he's written a great article called, I think it's Abstention in the Time of Ferguson. And he makes the point, which not many folks have done, that, you know, Younger abstention absolutely should not be a tool for kicking people out of federal court when the folks are trying to vindicate these systemic or structural kind of class-wide rights. And it's great to see that idea kind of getting traction with the majority in this case. And in the Fourth Circuit in particular, I mean, there are certainly some circuits, I would say the Seventh Circuit is one of them, which are pretty reflexive when it comes to kicking folks out on pretty aggressive views of Younger abstention. The Fourth Circuit really has a history of looking critically at these kinds of defenses that the governments raise. This is one example of that. So, you know, it's a super exciting case. Younger abstention continues to be just where all the excitement is at when it comes to
hot.
Yeah, civil rights litigation. I'll add, as I said, there's like a couple of page dissent from Judge Rushing. She ultimately agreed that just based on a straightforward application of Supreme Court doctrinal Younger precedent, that Younger shouldn't apply here. But she said, okay, so maybe we should just say that and not talk about all of these broader issues with the doctrine.
I have one question. So I find very plausible the notion that I find it impractical, as you suggested, the notion that you can get structural relief in state court in a 10-minute status conference in a some sort of, you know, foster care status hearing. Would there have been a way, or did the court even discuss whether they could proceed on a class basis but in state court? Was that on the table?
Yeah, so the Fourth Circuit alluded to it, but I think that kind of proves the problem almost with the abstention doctrine here, right? Because, you know, the notion of abstention isn't that the federal courts are going to say, we think that you should have picked a different forum to try to vindicate your rights. It's that, you know, you're already in some kind of state forum and we're going to defer to that. So so really what the majority said, I think they kind of touched on that point and said, really, if we're talking about meaningful relief in this kind of context, the choice isn't between showing up at your status conference and federal class actions. It's between federal class actions and state class actions. And the plaintiffs are allowed to make that choice. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Scott, have you ever had a Younger harpoon thrown at you or thrown one yourself?
You know, I was trying to remember that. I may have once thrown a Younger harpoon now that I think about it.
We won't talk about that.
Raised a Younger issue. I don't remember. I was actually thinking, I think I have, but I can't recall a specific instance. But I used to do a pro bono work through the Minnesota Children's Law Center. And so I have been in these foster care status conferences, which can be very brief, very cursory. And the notion of raising, even for an individual client, you know, systemic problems, I just don't think that seems practical.
And one, it really brings up the kind of the major reason for the Younger exception in the first place, which is that it applies if in the state court proceedings you can raise these claims and have an adequate forum or what if the phraseology is. And this just isn't, I mean, I think this is maybe the most extreme version I've ever seen of that just not applying. You know, there's all kinds of ways where I know in some good case law that the courts have said, well, it doesn't apply where, you know, it's an administrative proceeding and you couldn't have an adequate record made, or you couldn't even appeal in some cases, no final judgment. I mean, this is just it utterly laughable that you could have any kind of anything similar to a federal class action lawsuit. Well, thank you both for both the sale of the Younger Seas and the Indian law versus tribal law distinction. Scott, is there anything else, any hot topics in your practice that people should be watching for or cases they should be following?
You know, I see only hot topics, but they're also esoteric. It's hard to begin one at this point. But yes, the answer is yes, but a non-specific yes.
I see. Well, people should then keep their eyes glued to both the federal courts and some of the state courts, including the Minnesota Supreme Court, where you have a case pending. Sam, thank you for coming on, and we'll have you on again sometime. Maybe younger, maybe something else. When you've caught your white whale. In the meantime, though, I'd like everyone to thank everyone for listening. Remind everybody that we have, if you're in the New York City area, we have our Short Circuit Live coming up on October 26th. We'll put a link up to that in the show notes, and we'll be talking about it in future episodes as well. And for everyone else, I'd ask that you get engaged.